I'm Keith Law. Welcome to episode 118 of The Keith Law Show. I'll be joined today by author David Grand to talk about his new book, The Wager. You may be familiar with his work, some of his previous work. He also wrote the book Killers of the Flower Moon, which is going to be a movie on Apple TV Plus releasing later this year. Also the book The Lost City of Z, which was a movie, came out a couple of years ago, which was also adapted, I should say, into a movie. I am a huge fan of David's writing and I'm very, very excited for this conversation. In the meantime, I've been a little bit absent from The Athletic just because I got sick. I got not COVID, so it felt a lot like COVID. According to the home test, I didn't have COVID. I have questions, certainly, but I was pretty sick for about a day or so, and then had the wonderful lingering cough that I get basically whenever I get any kind of respiratory infection, like a mild cold, doesn't matter. I'll have a cough for 2 weeks. It's great. It's great. If anyone has a couple of spare lungs they'd like to throw my way, feel free. I will be returning probably later this week with a draft blog post. I was out briefly in Southern California, saw a couple of prospects there. We'll be seeing a couple more draft prospects this week. And then hitting some minor league games, too. The minor league season is completely underway. Blue Rocks had their home opener. I was there sort of in a non-work capacity, just to go support the local team. Did see a little bit of Kumar Rocker while I was there. He was 94, 95, pretty good slider, probably a better slider than I had seen from him when I saw him before the draft in June of 2022. Of course, we'll see how that holds up. He did dominate in a very short outing, but also he is way too advanced to be in high A. I almost look at this as a tune-up or a rehab outing for him. And the Blue Rocks, my hometown team here in Wilmington, are led by James Wood, whose name you might know from the Juan Soto trade. And I've seen a little bit of Wood before, but this was probably the best I'd seen him run and the best I'd seen him play center field, both of which extremely impressive, especially for somebody of his size. Now, I'm very excited to be joined by the author David Grand, whose new book, The Wager, A Tale of Shipwreck, Mutiny, and Murder, is due out on April 18th. He's also the author of Killers of the Flower Moon, which has been adapted by some guy named Martin Scorsese into a film that's coming out on Apple TV this fall. David, thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So I loved Killers of the Flower Moon, just to mention, too, there's a really great audiobook of that. But today we're going to talk primarily about The Wager, which I tore through in about two and a half days on my recent spring training trip to Arizona. It's absolutely fascinating, but I also thought it was kind of obscure from today's vantage point. Like, I don't think many people know about the ship, know about the story. I sort of wrote in my notes here, this isn't even the most famous mutiny in British naval history. So how did you first stumble on this story and then discover that there was enough here to make a whole book out of it?
Yeah, so it was interesting. I've actually always been fascinated by mutinies, including the more famous, the Mutiny on the Bounty. and also, like, even in films like Crimson Tide, and, you know, it's just the kind of a staple of literature. And I think in part because it's really interesting when it's a very distinct kind of rebellion when it is part of a military organization whose very mission is to impose order. So what causes members of a military organization to suddenly rebel? Are they these kind of outlaws? Or, as they're often depicted in a film, is there something rotten at the core of the system that justifies the rebellion and maybe gives it some nobility? So in any case, I always was interested in that. And I was doing some research on mutinies while looking for a new book. And lo and behold, I came across an 18th century journal written by John Byron, who had been a 16-year-old midshipman when the voyage set out. The book is old and brittle with faded text, and it's written in archaic English with stilted prose and F's as S's. And yet the more I read it, the more spellbound I was, because it was describing things like typhoons and tidal waves and what he called the perfect hurricane, and icebergs and earthquakes, and then a shipwreck, and then being castaways on an island, and then this insurrection on the island in which many of the men turned upon each other in this real life Lord of the Flies. And I realized that this little odd journal held the seeds to one of the most extraordinary sagas of survival and adventure I had ever come across, On top of that, John Byron went on to become the grandfather of the poet Lord Byron, whose work was greatly influenced by what he referred to as my great granddad's narrative. So I thought I had the seeds of a great deal, but I yet, you know, to your question of, you know, kind of what's its resonance, why this story? And the more I looked into it, what intrigued me as much as what had happened on the island was what had happened after several of the castaways made it back to England. And thereafter, they've waged a war against all these elements, including scurvy and storms and whatnot. They are suddenly summoned to face a court-martial, and after everything they've been through, they may be hanged for their alleged crimes on the island. So hoping to save their lives and to sway public opinion, they publish various accounts of what had happened on the island, and they begin to wage a war over the truth. It just to kind of button that up is, so I was looking into this, not yet committed fully yet to doing a book, and I would go to the archives, read these various old accounts. Then I would come home and I'd flip on the news, you know, on TV and cable, and, you know, they'd be talking about alternative facts and so-called fake news and disinformation. And I was like, whoa, this is so odd. And then I would go to the archives and I would be reading about the story, and there was like a war over who would get to tell the history and efforts by those in power to cover up the history. And then I would come home and there were battles over what books could be taught, including even Killers of the Flower Moon. And I thought, oh my goodness, like this weird 18th century story is not only gripping, it's not only this insane gripping sea yarn, but it's also like a parable for our own times.
One of the challenges that I imagine came about in writing this book, and that, just speaking as a reader, I think you tackled successfully, but you have a lot of different narratives that probably conflicted quite a bit in many of these journals and other publications that you're talking about. So can you tell me a little bit about the process of trying to weave them together, especially when you're not 100% sure who's telling the truth? In fact, I would imagine there are certain points where you say, I have no idea who's telling the truth out of all these accounts.
Yeah. So, you know, it is a classic war over the truth. And one of the things that drew me to it is that you can really document how each person is shading the story. And I think it gets at something very larger about the way we all tell stories. We all try to emerge as the hero of them, to live what we've done or haven't done. Now, in their case, if they didn't tell a convincing tale, they could literally be hanged. So the stakes are life and death in the way they tell their story. And so I wanted to find a structure that got at that and could illuminate that and also be transparent about the very question you just said, which is, what is the truth? And so I chose to tell the story from three conflicting perspectives of three members of the wager. One member was the captain, David Cheap. He was somebody who on land was always kind of chased by creditors and facing defeats. But at sea, he had always found refuge, and he had finally attained on this voyage what he had always longed for, his dream of captaining his own warship and possibly capturing a lucrative prize, a treasure ship. And then the other perspective is from the gunner, John Bulkley, who in many ways was the most skilled seaman on the wager. And he was an instinctive leader, but because he didn't come from the aristocracy, he knew it was unlikely that he would ever be able to become captain of a ship. And then the third perspective is from the young John Byron, the childlike eyes, who's kind of witnessing this, who's kind of filled with romance when he sets out, and then must come of age amid the horrors of the elements and the horrors unleashed by his own seamen. And so by showing each of their accounts, hopefully I can illuminate for the reader how each of them is shading their stories. What's interesting is they generally agree on the basic facts. They don't so much outright lie as what they decide to leave out of their own accounts, or what they choose to burnish, or what they choose to edit. So you might have one of them say, I was forced to proceed to extremities on the island. And then you'll look at the other account describing that same situation, and the person will say, oh yeah, he shot him right in the head. That was the force to proceed to extremities. So you begin to see the shading. And I think the reader can both gain insights into these characters by what they're emphasizing or what they're leaving out, And hopefully I leave it to the reader's judgment to try to ascertain the truth, which I think you can kind of do, but I do leave that up to the reader and the reader's judgment.
Do you feel like there is a villain in this story? Because I can't, again, I keep coming back to, you know, on the HMS Bounty, where I've read the book. I think I read it, an abridged version of the book as a child, and then read the actual book as an adult, and watched one of the movies,
yeah,
the one that won the Academy Award in the 30s, I think it was, which
yes,
was not great. Most of those early Academy Award winners have not aged very well. And I won't vouch that I paid attention through the entire thing. But of course, all of those have a slant, and you're not trying to come in with a slant to your story, and you're trying to convey this narrative as faithfully as you can. And I came out of it thinking, I don't know that there's really a villain. You could argue there's an antagonist, but you can also see his side. And I think you're, by using his narrative also, you do a good job of representing all of those sides. And it made me come out saying, yeah, I like this version more than this. But I think this guy comes out a little bit better than that guy. But I'm not coming down very strongly. I'm all on, say, Bulkley's side, or all on Byron's side, or for that matter, all on Cheap's side, who is the one who I did ultimately come down and say, yeah, he's probably more at fault than the other people.
Yeah, I think that's a really good observation, in that it's just a story with not kind of reductive villains and heroes. You know, Killers of the Flower Moon was such a crystalline version of good and evil. And this is a story that's more murky. The each person is fallible and deeply human. And the island and this voyage becomes a kind of laboratory that tests the human condition under very extreme circumstances. And inevitably, you slowly see it begin to reveal the hidden nature of each person. And you see the good, and you see the bad, and you see those often in the same person. You could at one moment be following somebody and be struck by their acts of courage, gallantry, and bravery, and then several moments later suddenly recoil at some shocking act of brutality. And so I think you see the whole spectrum of human nature being played out. And you can, you know, my job as a writer, I never see my job as to absolve people or to, overly sympathize necessarily. It's, I'm just trying to render them as best I can the way they are, with their flaws and their misperceptions and their goodness and often their badness too.
It seemed like you made a bit of a conscious choice also to avoid dwelling too much on just the physical misery of their time on Wager, what we now call Wager Island, or Isla Wager, if you want to look for it, as I did on Google Maps, which is quite, I was saying to you, David, just before we started recording too, I ended up down quite the rabbit hole too, because I'm trying to trace, well, where might they have sailed, and where did this particular longboat go? And it's extremely forbidding. And there's nobody there. There's not even a settlement anywhere close to there. So they couldn't have washed up in a worse place, clearly. But you made the choice not to spend too much time in the physical misery, which I appreciate, because I feel like we've seen that before. We've read that. Also, that's really painful and uncomfortable to read. Like, death by starvation is not pleasant. So instead, I was impressed and pleased. We don't spend a ton of time actually on the island. That is actually a somewhat small portion of the book relative to what I expected. It is much more about what led into it and what led after. For example, you talk a lot about the construction of these ships and why these ships ran aground or just simply fell apart so often, which was fascinating, something I had never seen before in any book I had ever read about ships, shipwrecks, mutinies, all of this, you know, naval history. Mm-hmm. So was that a conscious choice? And were you, especially to delve into something, again, seemingly as arcane as ship construction, but that ended up being, I thought, very illustrative to what came after and why these men ended up in this terrible situation.
Yes, I thought that this was a story about a floating civilization that begins to unravel and to disintegrate and collapse on the island. So before you understand the collapse of this kind of floating fortress, which is the ship, the warship, you need to understand how it's built and what their life is like on it, how it's regimented, and the civilization that exists, including the building of these ships. And the seeds of their destruction in many ways are planted at the very outset of the voyage, as the British Navy, short of men, begins to press many people, just rounding them up, going to cities and ports and looking if they have the telltale signs of a mariner's, and then shoving them onto a boat under grates and thrusting them onto these voyages that's going to last for as long as 3 years unwillingly. And they're still short of men, and they go and they actually round up people from a pensioner home, retirement home, some of whom are in their 60s and 70s, many of whom are missing an assortment of limbs, some of whom are so sick. They are so sick before the voyage begins. They are being lifted on stretchers onto the boat to set off. And somehow this odd collection of people, many of them are willing and recalcitrant, along with others on the ship, including dandies and aristocrats and free black seamen, and are all thrown together and somehow need to be formed into a band of brothers. And they need to be placed on on one of these warships, which are these kind of engineering marvels of their time, three-masted with cannons that make them lethal, propelled by sail, and yet also very vulnerable because they are made all of wood, which is very perishable. You know, they weren't made of iron. And so they're all susceptible to the elements and to worms. And so you kind of need to understand that this world that is literally kind of built, this vessel that is built, it's as if you were building a globe, a small floating globe. You know, it was like an ark. It was like, I'm forgetting my biblical figure, placing them on the ark, the animals. Noah, thank you. Yes. It's tired. It's an early morning. Putting certain people on the ship. And so they have to build the ship. A ship could be built from, take 4,000 trees to build a single one of these warships. It has to both be a military instrument, but also serve as the home. And so you need to understand this kind of self-enclosed, claustrophobic, floating fortress and civilization, if you're then going to understand what it means when it all collapses. So that's why I spent a lot of time doing that. I also just geeked out and became wildly fascinated by the sociology on these ships, by the way these ships were built and what it took.
One sort of unfortunate fact that, again, you sort of sent me down various rabbit holes online. So there's a scurvy outbreak on the ship. And scurvy is apparently also a pretty miserable way to die, or just a pretty miserable way to not die, as it turns out. And I thought, God, hadn't they figured this out by now? Obviously, I knew scurvy was a thing, right? This is how we got British soldiers, British Navy midshipmen, various were called limeys, because there were citrus fruits on all of these boats to try to ward off scurvy. And it was about 5 years after the Voyager first set sail, I think, that the first experiment, so to speak, where they just gave citrus fruits to British sailors so that they wouldn't get scurvy. So it seemed also like there was a bit of, it was just very unfortunate timing. This story happens 10 years later. And if nothing else, more men survive to the point of the shipwreck. And then maybe what happens afterwards is, I guess it could have been worse also. I was thinking it was better because it was simply more manpower and they wouldn't have been quite so emaciated by the time they washed up. But it was just this very unfortunate accident of timing, maybe one of the last major such shipwrecks where they were also crushed by scurvy.
So what's interesting about scurvy, when you look back on the literature, there were a few officers who kind of realized, without scientific knowledge, that, when some of their men had scurvy and they'd land on an island and eat fruit or vegetables, they would get better. But it was never kind of collectively recognized or incorporated. And it was actually after this expedition, not before, that one of the first major experiments took place. But even and it really was kind of a blind study, and they really did show that this scientist really did, this doctor really did show that unquestionably citrus fruit helped people with scurvy. Even then, though, it wasn't yet, you know, it's the sad part of knowledge. It still wasn't yet actually fully recognized by the Navy. So it would still take several more decades before British ships and other naval ships began to carry citrus fruit and vegetables. And let's just talk a little bit about scurvy, because so they set voyage, and almost everything begins to go wrong. And you know, they have misery on the island, but they have kind of an earlier stages of descending into what I would call essentially a hell. So first they have to get around Cape Horn. And for those listeners who don't know Cape Horn, and they maybe they've heard at the tip of South America, oh, the seas are bad. It was another thing I didn't know much about. And like, oh yeah, the seas are really bad. And one of the reasons they're really bad is because it's the only place, you know, it's just so interesting to me when you learn this stuff. It's the only place on the earth where the seas flow completely uninterrupted around the globe. They're not blocked by land. So waves can accumulate power over 13,000 miles. I think that's right. 13,000 miles. A wave, a 90-foot wave could dwarf a map of a ship. It's the strongest currents in the world there. Kind of the water just shoots through this funnel. And then there are the winds, which can accelerate off into hurricane force and can reach as much as 200 miles per hour. The novelist Herman Melville, who later made this voyage, around the Horn, compared it to a descent into hell in Dante's Inferno. And so the ships get there, the squadron, the Wager is part of the squadron of ships. They are chasing the Spanish galleon filled with treasure, which is known as the prize of all the oceans. And as they're rounding Cape Horn, they are just battered by storms day and night, day and night. The ships are breaking apart. The Wager loses a mast. And Captain David Cheap and all the other officers know they are going to need every person on these ships if they're going to persevere, because these ships take hundreds of people to operate. And lo and behold, what happens? Scurvy. They are hit by scurvy at this time. They knew the term scurvy. They used the term scurvy, but they didn't know what caused scurvy. Their teeth began to fall out. Their hair fell out. The cartilage that glued together their bones seemed to be coming undone. There's one story that really struck me. There was a report of a man who had been in a battle 5 decades earlier where he had fractured a limb. And now suddenly that long since healed fracture just suddenly mysteriously shatters in the same spot. The other thing I didn't know about scurvy at the time was how it can affect your senses. And it's a vitamin deficiency. And as one of the seamen described, the disease got into our brains and we went raving mad. They descended, many of them descended into lunacy, and hundreds of them perished, their bodies just unceremoniously tossed overboard. There's a line from the poet, if I can get it right, Lord Byron, John Byron's grandson, where he described it as, "Without a grave, unknelled, uncoffined, and unknown." Hopefully I got that right. But in any case, it just gives you a sense of what kind of epitaph you had just going to the depths of the bottom of the sea. So that's happening. This has all happened even before they've shipwrecked.
One of the other obstacles they dealt with was they didn't actually know where they were. And at one point around Cape Horn, when they're deciding whether they need to turn back or not, which is in and of itself, obviously a very difficult decision to make, because turning back was not easy, but continuing forward into the unknown wasn't easy. They didn't necessarily know where they were, because we are before the invention of the chronometer. So they might know their latitude, but they certainly didn't know their longitude. And there is a long section where I don't want to spoil too much, but essentially they go the wrong way, because they cannot properly figure out where they are or what direction they're heading in. And it seems like that was yet another case. There were so many different things here. Well, if only this were a little later, if only this happened. But the confluence of all of these things going wrong, obviously it's why it makes for such a riveting story. But it was a number of these little things that made it, the story that it is, also made it seem incredibly foolhardy to me. It's why did anybody ever leave England.
Well, I think some of them left unwillingly, thrown onto that ship they didn't want to go.
Very true.
Some went with dreams of glory and wealth, and others went unwillingly. But yes, you know, they, because they did not, they could determine their latitude because they could read the stars, but mm-hmm. because they did not have reliable clocks, they could not determine their longitude. And so they had to rely on what was known as dead reckoning, which mm-hmm. essentially amounted to, you know, informed guesswork and a leap of faith. And there's a good reason why it is called dead reckoning, because you often mm-hmm. ended up dead. And they turn out on multiple occasions just to be wildly wrong about where they actually are on the map.
So you mentioned several points in the book that their stories, the various stories from the returning castaways, from Captain Cheap to Byron and on down, influenced a number of Enlightenment thinkers, from philosophers like Jean-Jacques Rousseau, even to the, you know, who we now know as a scientist, Charles Darwin. So can you talk a little bit about how their stories resonated and what exactly was it that these various philosophers and scientists ended up taking away from the various narratives of the survivors?
Yeah, so when these accounts, you know, it's funny because this story is now virtually forgotten. I mean, I had certainly never heard of it. And I think if you probably asked 99% of even people in Britain if they've heard of it, they wouldn't have heard of this this saga. But it was once a sensation. And after several of the castaways released their accounts and were facing court-martial, you know, it depicted the British Empire in a very scandalous light because it undercut the central claim of the ruthless expansion of the British Empire, which was somehow that their civilization was superior to others. And yet here on the island, they had slowly descended into a Hobbesian state of depravity in which their officers often and their crewmen, the so-called apostles of Western civilization, behave more like brutes than gentlemen. So those accounts caused a sensation. And then there is kind of a triumphant narrative that England will kind of seize upon to kind of, you know, erase part of the story and burnish another part of the story. And that account also becomes a kind of smashing bestsellers. And these accounts were poured over, as you say, by the philosophers of the day. Sometimes Rousseau and Voltaire were pouring them over, partly because they brought back early reports of other places that were unknown. They also obviously highlighted the conduct of these various officers and seamen during the expedition. Darwin had brought these accounts with him on the voyage of the Beagle and would consult them. And then Herman Melville in his novel, one of his novels, cites them. And Patrick O'Brien, another one of the great novelists of the sea, one of his early novels before his kind of Master and Commander, Masterful series, was based loosely on the Wager disaster. There's even a character named John Byron. So these stories kind of radiated out and had influence. And of course, one of the themes of the book is how that happens. And it's about not only how individuals shape their stories to serve their self-interest, but also ultimately how empires shape their story to serve their self-interest. And one of the stories that kind of gets burnished and passed down is this almost kind of alternative history, this mythic version of what happened that kind of glosses over in the end all the horrors.
Did anything change for, obviously we talked about the scurvy situation, so I'm thinking aside from that, but did anything change just for sailors in the wake of everything that happened in the Wager, whether it's how ships were captained or how ships were constructed, or was this yet another, I mean, like you mentioned with scurvy too, where they sort of knew what the cure probably was, and for decades they went on still not doing something about it. It keeps reminding me of the Ignaz Semmelweis story of the guy who realized you just had to wash your hands to get rid of germs.
Yes, the germs, right? Yes.
And literally died in an insane asylum because nobody would listen to him. And they thought it was not possible for gentlemen doctors to possibly carry germs on their hands. And it seems Like we still do this today. I'm not going to claim we're any better as a species, but certainly a lot of these stories back then are lessons unheeded or unlearned. And it's certain, and the Wagers story had plenty of lessons. Did anybody learn anything? Did anything get better in the wake of all of these men, the men who did survive coming back and publishing their accounts?
Yes. So the commodore, the head of the expedition of this squadron of five ships, was a man named George Anson, who was a very skilled commander, had a real mastery over his ship. And he heeded many of the lessons that were wrought from this expedition when he eventually makes it back to England, and he is promoted and eventually is promoted to the point where he becomes in charge of the British Navy. And he implements various reforms to professionalize the force, to try to avoid the kind of, these kind of pensioners who were kind of thrown on the ship in this, you know, who were so sick. Also changing the rules to create a clearer discipline and order and regimen, even after a shipwreck. So, for example, on the Wager, one of the questions that arose was, once they were on the island, were they still subject to military regulations? He specifically changed the rules. So he really did try to, you know, in subtle ways, improve and modernize the British Navy based on this expedition. And many historians, although he's now kind of been overshadowed by other naval figures, is often considered the father of the British Navy. The one element where it didn't cause a corrective was towards the imperialistic nature and venture of the British Empire and the destruction that that ended up imposing on such a large scale, as well as slavery.
So I do have to ask, I loved Killers of the Flower Moon. I've been waiting to see this movie for a while now. I think the release date is now October of this year, which puts it right into awards season also. I don't know how much you were directly involved in the film. You know, I'm curious if you've seen any of it so far, if there's anything you can tease here. This DiCaprio guy seems like he might be the next big thing. So he's a name to watch.
Yeah, so, you know, my involvement is limited. You know, we talk about the structure on a ship. You know, there's like the captain, you know, with a movie, and then like on a ship, everyone gets structured. Then there's like the lieutenant, then you go to the, you know, the petty officers and the warrant officers, then you go to the able seamen and the forecastle men, and then you go to the ordinary seamen, and then you go to the people who are on the waist of the ship. They're known as the wasters, and they're often the landlubbers who are there, or the least skilled and just have manual labor. Well, that's the author when you get to it. When you get to a movie production, you're like the waster. You're just in the middle of the ship. Watching the way they have adapted this story, this history, it's a true story, which is about really one of the more sinister crimes in American history and one of the worst racial injustices. And since I don't know much about films, you know, my hope with these projects is always to get it into the hands of people to share that kind of fierce commitment to the story. And Scorsese and DiCaprio and Lily Gladstone and De Niro and everyone who worked on this production, I think really did. And I think that the thing to tease, or the thing to underscore, which was really most important to me, was very early on, they began to work with the Osage Nation in how to tell the story, to shape the story. The Osage Nation, Chief Standing Bear and others lobbied for them to film on location, which is pretty rare, I guess, these days. I don't know much, but I think it's pretty rare. And they end up filming on Osage territory in the places where many of these events transpired, sometimes even in buildings where some of these events transpired. There are many Osage actors with talking roles. The Osage were involved in teaching the Osage language to the various actors and helping to revive this wonderful language. From the costumes to the production design. And, you know, the craziest thing was when I went to the set, it was completely surreal because, you know, I work with words. I create, look at documents, and I look at photographs too, but I create visual images in my brain from mostly text, from words. And then you suddenly show up And here is a visual, a literal manifestation of what had been in my head from documents, you know, where they have reconstructed this world. And I never liked the term surreal because it always seems kind of vague to me, but it really was surreal because, you know, it was such a detailed replication of this world. And my great hope with this film, and I think the acting is really quite remarkable, I think people will find. I think from Lily Gladstone and DiCaprio, I think people are going to be really struck and disturbed by that relationship and the way they play it. But, you know, my hope is when I wrote that book was to hopefully address my own ignorance and the ignorance of many others outside the Osage Nation who never learned anything about this history. You know, we had basically never been taught it, or we had just excised it from our consciousness. And my hope is that the film will go even further in sharing this history to others, which will then lead people like you, when you read The Wager, hopefully, to go down rabbit holes and to begin to do their own research and their own looking. Maybe they'll visit the Osage Nation, they'll go to the museum the way I did early on. Maybe they'll learn about the Osage language. So I think that is the way, you know, kind of history and knowledge grows, which is kind of why we hopefully do these things. And I was also really, obviously, over the moon when Scorsese and DiCaprio said they wanted to team up again to do The Wager.
Absolutely. Yes, I'm dying to see who DiCaprio ends up playing. The older he gets, right, as you start, you still think of DiCaprio as a young man.
I'll tell you who he plays. He plays Ernest Burkhart, who marries Molly Burkhart in the real story. He is one of the white settlers, and has a very complicated character that I think DiCaprio just peels away throughout the film, getting to the core of his nature.
My guest today has been the great David Gran, the author of the new book, The Wager, A Tale of Shipwreck, Mutiny, and Murder, due out on April 18th. And of course, as we were just discussing, also of the book Killers of the Flower Moon, which has been adapted by Martin Scorsese and will be out on Apple TV, hopefully at some point this fall. David, thank you so much for joining me.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much, Keith.
That's all for this week's show. Thank you so much for joining me. As I've said a few times recently, this show is going to be as weekly as I can possibly make it around upcoming travel. I do have a fair bit of travel, although mostly short trips, coming up in the next couple of weeks, and then we'll be bearing down more on minor league stuff. So the draft stuff will shift more to writing, less to actually seeing players, while I'll be going out and seeing as many minor league games as I can in terms of prospects who come close to me here in the Mid-Atlantic region. I will also have another board game review up over at Paste of Twilight Inscription, which is probably the longest roll and write game I have ever played or seen. I actually mentioned it in my piece at Wirecutter earlier this month, where I talked about roll and write games as a trend and gave recommendations of five of them. I actually had Twilight Inscription there for people who are particularly hardcore gamers and don't mind sitting down for 2 hours or more at the table. I have to admit, it's a little bit much. My attention span is not quite that long. I'm the guy who complains whenever a movie is over 2.5 hours. Like, no, that is two sittings at that point. You have already broken this up into two separate sittings for me. It's just not possible for me to sit still for that long. Anyway, that is all for this week's show. Thank you so much for joining me. Stay safe.